Hey everyone, I'm Rachelia. So glad to welcome you all back for part two together with the esteemed Rabbi Kaganoff, who will continue to answer the questions that have been sent in. With much gratitude for your time and willingness to help us, I hand it over to Rabbi Kaganoff.
Okay, thank you very much, Rachelia. So before I start, I don't want to forget that we should all ask for Hashem to grant us siyata d'shmaya, that we should be able to understand the Ratz and His will in the Torah for us, as I will be discussing, and that I should also understand it properly, convey it to you properly. There were a lot of questions that came in, and I encourage those questions because this way there's further clarification. I don't see you as an audience. You don't see my body language. I don't see your body language, so it's hard for me to gauge whether or not what I'm saying is understood or not. So the fact that you ask more questions are good. It prompts me to clarify further, and you'll understand. And as one of my mentors and teachers taught me many years ago when I was a child, he used to say, the only silly / or stupid question is the one that wasn't asked. So there's nothing as a silly or stupid question. If you didn't understand something, ask the question. If you don't want to ask it afterwards in our question and answer, then we... if we don't understand the, if you don't want to ask the question in person, at the end of the session, we have our question answered. Then we certainly, send it in by email to Rachelia. She'll pass it along to me. Okay. We're going to deal with the clarifications, the questions that were asked about clarification on our first topic of masturbation. We're going to deal with those first. There were other issues that were raised, other topics. And if there's time today, then we will go back to them. Perhaps there will be. If there isn't, then we will have yet, another session. We'll schedule something else in order to finish up which had not been completed. Okay, so I'm going more or less in order of the questions as I received them. There may be some redundancy here, but I believe that that will help the clarification process. Okay. Question one. In part one of the shiur, I believe it was said that there is no place for masturbation in a healthy marriage. Does this also apply when the woman is in nida or for some reason doesn't have access to relations with her husband? Okay, so the answer to that based on the question, in a healthy marriage, the purpose of sex in a marriage is not just about having children. The sex in the marriage is about creating a very, very profound bond between husband and wife, right? The sexual pleasure, the enjoyment of sex is the most powerful pleasure that Hashem has created in the world. Its purpose is to take a man and a woman and make them inextricably bound up with one another. They become a unit, right? That unit is good for themselves personally, for their own benefit and welfare, and even more so, it's for the absolute benefit of the children. The parents are united. There is a oneness of the parents parenting, then the children benefit immeasurably. Now, if there is no alternative to sex other than my partner, meaning my husband or my wife, all right, then the bond is even stronger. To that which I take this pleasure and I get it from somewhere else, so I diminish that bonding that takes place between the husband and wife. So if it's a healthy relationship, and when a woman is in nida, just like he has no access for his sexual expression because she's in nida, and does not have another wife, nor does he philander. He's totally loyal. So too, in a healthy marriage, a wife would be waiting with expectation for that pleasurable experience of mikveh night. Okay, and it's best just for him and for both the best. Now, that would be if she's in nida. Now, what about if no relations, husband is not available? Well, that depends why is he not available. Okay, if it's on an extended trip, likewise, just like he remains celibate, so also she. And that is, of course, we're talking about a healthy relationship, right, or healthy people. Then we have the opposite, the opposing piece, that's called therapeutic. So if she is not well, for some reason, it's not a healthy relationship, or she has needs, all right, which we'll discuss further during today's questions, right? that he cannot satisfy. Right? So then we're not talking about really a healthy relationship, and then we have to fall back on the basic halachas, which we discussed last time and we'll continue to clarify this time, and that, you know, so she may have to use a masturbation, and maybe not may, but have to use the masturbation as a means of her sexual satisfaction. Okay, but the answer to this question is that if indeed it is a fully healthy marriage, then the masturbation should not really be a part of it, but the entire sexual satisfaction will be coming from the husband. Next question. Okay, you spoke in detail about what is permitted for a woman to do for her husband in the bedroom in terms of pre-relations activity, but I did not hear an explanation of what is permitted for a man to do for his wife in that respect. I feel like maybe it could be that there are activities that are permitted that we are not doing, which might enhance my marriage, and maybe I will not feel the need to satisfy myself outside of that context. I have written in a very discreet way. I hope my meaning is clear. Well, I hope so. I'll try to answer the best that I can. Okay? 1 minute, please. I'm sorry. I'm trying to. Okay. All right, so let's be very clear about here, okay? A husband has at least two mitzvahs, perhaps more, to satisfy his wife during sexual activity. All right, there's one called the mitzvah saseh of ona, which is the simach es ishto. He's supposed to make his wife happy, and that means sexually satisfied, supposed to satisfy her needs. And if he denies it to her or neglects to live up to the expectations, then he's potentially transgressing a lo saseh, which is in parshas mishpatim, lo sigla, not a lo sigla, that he's not allowed to diminish or withhold from her the sexual pleasures that he's supposed to give her. So we're dealing here with a husband's responsibility, both an aseh and a lo saseh. Now, it could be that in our society, because women are taught not to speak up too much about it, that in a marriage, she may not speak up about the fact that she's not being satisfied, in which case he's clueless. Maybe he'll be clueless that he's not doing it. So there is a necessity on the part of a woman to say that if I'm not satisfied, to let him know. It has to be done, of course, properly, but and beforehand to be discussed, that she open conversations, which are also one of those things that have become a taboo. We don't talk about these things in marriage. We don't talk about these things when people go around unhappily married and unsatisfied because, you know, we're not supposed to talk about these things, which is, of course, contrary to what the halacha would expect over here because there's a mitzvah on the line. Here's a mitzvah saseh and a law saseh possibly if he's not satisfying her. Okay, now, his obligation, right, is to give her pleasure, right, and bring her to orgasm. Okay, now, and the pleasure should be anything that she desires as foreplay, including the imagination almost, okay? Now, that's just, I shouldn't say that the imagination is because there are certain halachos that certain things should not be done, okay? But in therapeutic modality, they would be permitted. So, for example, the halacha says that he should not kiss her on her genital area. Okay, actually on her vagina, very specifically. Shouldn't kiss her vagina. It doesn't mean the outside parts of the vulva, but it means on the vagina. Okay, it says you shouldn't look at her erva. Now, those are things that are there. We'll discuss a little bit later about the kedusha aspect, but ikar hadin, right, those are the only two that are ikar hadin, and even then they are relaxed, even those two are relaxed in cases where it's necessary for therapeutic reasons. Okay, but otherwise, if she wants to be touched, however she wants to be touched, stroked, again, I'm not sure what women imagine completely. I don't have a full repertoire. But basically, it is his responsibility to give her that satisfaction, right? And then during intercourse, during the tashmish, during sex, that he has to make sure she has an orgasm. Now, it becomes tricky. Because since men are wired to climax faster, and we discussed last time that ejaculation is a very big issue for him, ejaculation not within her vagina, So this becomes tricky because on one part, he is trying to, he would be trying to satisfy her, and he'll be ejaculating outside of her vagina, and she's not satisfied, we have a problem. Now, Chazal anticipated this, and Chazal therefore instructed, they said, the men should learn something called Shoha al Habetet, which means he should learn how to tarry when on her abdomen, which of course means undressing during the sex activity. So he should tarry, okay? Which means he should give the wife her due first. That means bring her to orgasm first, and then he should climax and allow himself to climax as well. Now, in today's day and age, I probably would say that most men would say, now it's very difficult, they'll say it's impossible. Can't be done. Right? Well, Chazal are telling us that men should be able to train themselves. Could be the Chazal we're talking about in the time of Chazal, or perhaps the outside stimulation that men receive all the time was not quite the same as we have, not quite the same, not anything like the same with our technology that we have today. I do not know, but that is a Chazal we're instructing what should be done. And Moshe Feinstein already discusses this in a tshuva of his, where he writes that if he is going to try to give her due, he's trying to make her happy, wants to do what she needs, and in so doing, he's going to ejaculate first. So Ramosha says that what they should do is have a conversation. They should discuss it. The discussion should be like this. I want to make you happy, but I don't want to be over Yisur. And of course, her response will be the same thing. Yes, but I don't want you to be over Yisur, but on the other hand, I need to feel satisfied too, because otherwise, forget problems of Shalom Bayit. The Moshe says if the conversation is done correctly, then the following arrangement can be made. Okay? He will be allowed to climax first, and after he climaxes, then they'll have a subsequent session, almost immediately thereafter, where he will then bring her to orgasm. So that means that, therefore, his need and ejaculate of protecting the Ashkos Zera part will be taken care of, all right, because it will be done. Now, the fact that she wasn't fully satisfied the first time around, now he will make it up to her by bringing her to orgasm, okay? And hopefully that Moshe maintains that if both are Yirei Shemayim and want what's best for the marriage and for each other, that arrangement could be made, okay? Now, this is the way, so you're asking me the question over here, what would be permitted what's it for a man to do for his wife in that respect? Well, there you have it, I think. I mean, if there are any really specific things that I'm not imagining, I mean, the fondling, the touching, the vibrating, he can put his finger in and out of her vagina if that's what she wants. Fondling of the breast, fondling of the clitoris, whatever else that could be, that I'm not answering because she said in the discreet, I don't know if your meaning is clear, so then please you'll either ask afterwards in our questions and answers or else you write me in the question as well. Okay, I hope I addressed that well enough. Okay, you'll let me know, of course. Now, the second question she wrote over here is, what chizuk or practical advice would you give to a woman to women who are struggling with the issue being discussed, masturbation, and want to overcome it? What practical tools can we use to stop these inappropriate thoughts and actions? Okay, we're talking about here the masturbation and the pornography, all of these issues. Okay, so now, my word of chizuk is really not such a chizuk, but I guess it's a medical issue. All right? There's a need that these things are filling. In other words, there's looking at pornography or masturbating creates a response. The sexual response, the neurological response, the chemical response in the brain. It releases pleasure. Okay, now what is that? Why do I want that pleasure? Okay, most often if I'm compulsed or I find myself involved in that, it's because I'm trying to self-medicate. All right, there's some pain or something, discomfort. There's something going on inside subconsciously which I am now trying to counteract, make myself good, feel good by either masturbating, looking at pornography, by getting the sexual stimulation. So now the practical route about it is to go and do some deep therapy and discover what is going on internally that need, right, that subconscious need, that subconscious feeling of deprivation, subconscious need for reassurance or feeling good, what is causing that, right? Now, if I can find out at the root what's causing that, right, so then perhaps we can find out, we can then substitute an alternative, which is a healthier alternative, right, to take care of the discomfort that's going, the inner emotional discomfort that's going on inside. Now, there are numerous types of, now regular talk, and this is a little bit off topic, but it is answering the question. Generally, these type of issues that go on internally are something that are in the realm of what's called as complex childhood trauma. And those words are frightening, I guess, but I write about it extensively in my book, which I understand Rachel has copies, so it's available for others to have if they want. I write extensively in my book about the causes of so many things that are wrong in our community, psychological issues, emotional issues that go on in our community are due to because of what we call complex childhood trauma, which the United States government has categorized and researched and found that there are actually 10 different possibilities and we can't blame everything or think everything is because of molestation as a child. There are other things which are quite common, right, which means just that what we call an invalidating parent, right, which can trigger these type of emotional, deep-seated emotional responses within the brain. And therefore, the brain automatically triggers to look for these types of things of self-medication. And there are regular talk therapy, which also I document in my book, regular talk therapy does not address it. It'll perhaps scratch the surface, but it won't go to the depths, all the way to the depths of the core, because the part of the brain affected is really a very primitive part of the brain and is not amenable. It's like trying to tell a baby of 3 years old, not 3 years old, earlier, a six-month-old baby, try to discuss with it about how it should not make in its diaper, right? And that's ludicrous. You can't rationally deal with a six-month-old baby, right? So much or a good part of these type of maladaptive behaviors, these behaviors that are not appropriate, right, are because of that part of the brain is seeking to be soothed, and it's looking for, and it has learned that the pornography or the masturbation or the addictions or whatever else we have, right, the obsessive compulsive disorder, all sorts of mental health disorders and addictions and these types of things are as a result of this type of injury to the inner child. And we need specialized therapies to access it in order to rectify it. Those therapies have been developed over the last 15 years or so, no more, 20 years. And it's called inner child work, but because it's been so highlighted, so lots of therapists say they do inner child work, but they're really only talking to the inner child. They're not actually addressing the inner child's self. So there are things called, there's EMDR, and there's somatic experiencing, and there's internal family systems models, IFS. There's hypnosis. There's mindfulness. There's DBT. There are a lot of different modalities that have been created and are still being developed. To be able to address the inner child work. So you're asking what chizuk to be able to deal with these things is that we should have the courage to change, courage to do something. Practical advice is to seek out a therapist who's competent in understanding what actually complex childhood trauma is, and then go on a mission to find what is it that's triggering these behavior patterns, and why and what these anticipated behavior patterns are trying to accomplish, right? And then being able to resolve them and substitute a different response as opposed to the response that we're not happy with. Okay, now, the next question is a little bit lengthy, and I'll read it to you because I think it's important that the person should understand its importance, okay? My response, though, is going to be very similar into the next one as well, okay? So the young lady writes like this, I am a single Hasidic girl in Shidduchim. I listened to the first part of your question answers and found it to be extremely helpful, practical. However, I do have a specific question in regard to the topic of fantasizing. Okay? Anyone I've confessed this to have told me that they've never heard of such a thing before, which leads me to suspect that I'm a highly unusual case. I therefore understand if you choose to answer privately as opposed to on a public forum, okay, but I chose public. Ever since I can remember, I've had an extremely active imagination. I've always been able to daydream for literally hours on end. These daydreams are not random strains of thought, however. They are extremely complex storylines, somewhat similar to a book, except written in my head. They're also extremely intense to the point where I can actually begin mouthing the words the characters are saying in my mind. I recently did some research and self-diagnosed with a mild case of maladaptive daydreaming, which pretty much just means that what I described above. I was interested in what you suggested to check the link, and I did look at it, and I read the article, all right, and it helped clarify what the disorder is, maladaptive daydreaming. This wouldn't necessarily be a problem except for the fact that due to my experience over the last couple of years, my fantasizing has taken a turn for the romantic and even sexual. I need to mention that they are very rarely sexual. Storylines are more about romance than sex. However, they definitely focus on very specific people with whom the main character forms relationships with. I've had several times to stop, even completing a 90-day challenge once and then relapsing, and I'm finding it close to impossible. As I mentioned, I've been doing it obsessively for as long as I can remember, and I can't even imagine stopping. In my research, I haven't found anything helpful to stop it. Okay, my question is this. Do you think it might be halakhically permissible for me to continue daydreaming, fantasizing? I'm unsure as to which would be the correct term, so long as they remain romantic as opposed to sexual, and if not, do they have any suggestions? Do I have any suggestions to stop it? Okay, so now, once again, children daydream with this intensity almost always. All children do this, right? They daydream such intensity. In your situation specifically, you just never relinquished it. You never grew out of it like other children do, okay? And that means because it served a purpose to your subconscious in helping you cope or helping you enjoy. It sends a sense of satisfaction, soothing, being comfort. Okay, and that's why it's being continued. No, I'm not accusing you or blaming you. I'm just explaining the inner dynamic. Okay, now the reason why you probably not found anything in reading about it and in the literature about it is because it's only recent that research has been able to identify this phenomenon that I described in my book, and I just told you about all the complex childhood trauma syndrome, and it's only since the turn of the century, about 25 years, that it's even begun to develop. Some of the therapies are only about a dozen years old. So the literature and the establishment is slow in catching up. And to me, this would be simply another case of your symptoms, and the maladaptive daydreaming is just another aspect, another manifestation of the same issue. And my recommendation as far as therapy would be concerned is the same as I just said a moment ago, to seek out a therapist who specializes and studies complex childhood trauma and find out what actually subconsciously is going on. Now, to answer your question more directly, if you, as we said last time, if you fantasize romantically, so it depends what that means. I mean, to feel romantically that you're embracing a man, okay, is halakhically not permitted if you have a specific man in mind, okay? If you're thinking about some non-entity, general, generic man who's who will be your chassan, right? So we spoke last time that technically that's okay, right? Except that you may be setting yourself up for for disappointment, because you may fantasize about certain romantic experience, and the chassan is not going to deliver that, and you will be disappointed. Okay, so. I hope that will sort of like answer your question somewhat and give you some guidance. And if not, then I'm sure you will either ask later or send another email. Okay. Let us go to the next question. Yes, next question. Okay. I am single, so both of these would be for masturbation purposes. I know these are not recommended practices. I'd like to know the halakhic ruling nonetheless. First question is reading erotica often? Well, the answer, let's go to the second one first. That's easier. Listening to sounds which arouse oneself, is it often? No, the answer is no, it's mutter. Just like you can masturbate with yourself by touching, one of the ways to masturbate would be to by listening to sounds that arouse, okay? As long as those sounds are not, like we said last time, a nibble pad, they're not obscenities, right? And vulgarities, we spoke about last time as well. Vulgarities probably were also not appropriate, but the sounds that arouse would be okay for a woman, right? Now, what about reading, the first question was reading erotica, is it us? Well, erotica about someone else, right, or with someone else, right, is us. That's like we spoke last time, to think about doing an aveira, right, and having erotic encounters with other people or about other people is also, it's not permitted to do. If you mean erotica about yourself, which means by reading something about how to stimulate your own body or a description about your body which caused you to be aroused, it's all about doing it with yourself and about yourself, not including anybody else, right? So then that's part of the masturbation, which for women is permissible, right? Which would be permissible, correct, okay? I hope that answers that question. Excuse me, please. I apologize. Sorry. Okay, next question. Even though it is halakhically permissible, masturbation, that is, which we described, is there still something commendable about refraining from self-stimulation? Okay, the answer is yes. Okay, I'm going to clarify this in a minute. Okay, is it a level I should be striving to? Possibly, that's my answer to that one. Or is it a total neutral thing? I'll discuss that in a minute. Here I am referring to the spiritual aspect, meaning as a bhakti-sura, does it affect my level of kedusha, purity of my neshama, etc., when I masturbate? Okay. Now, this is a little bit, it's tricky, right? This is tricky, and we're rigorous honesty, and it's the challenge that I've had to deal with in this whole series here, okay? Yes, the answer to the question is that there are two parts. So when we started, what's the atzer, what's the hetzer? In other words, what's the ikra halacha? Okay, that's what I've been addressing mostly till now. Now we want to, there's something called kedoshim tiyu, right? The mitzvah say in the Torah that we should be kedoshim, we should be holy. And the word kedusha comes from v'yesem and the kriyashim v'yesem, kedoshim levokechem. Kedusha is defined as taking that which is mutter, right, and refraining from doing that in order to rise to a higher level of kedusha. Now that's dangerous, what I just said, okay? Because in our society, we think all or nothing, which means if I choose not to rise in kedusha, then I am a bad person. That is wrong. That's bad thinking. It's horrible thinking. As I mentioned last week briefly, let me reinforce it again. A number of years ago, we had a conversation with another Minsker Rebbe, I'm a Talmud of his, other Talmudim, we had a conversation. What is the role of a chumrah? What is a chumrah? What is a chumrah about? So he clarified, a chumrah is a means of demonstrating that I want to come closer to Hashem, that I love you, Hashem. That's what a chumrah is supposed to mean. Now, if I do a chumrah, and I express the words that I want to, or I think I want, but in reality, all it is triggering a resentment and makes me feel, Hashem is harsh on me, or I don't like this, I don't want it. So I'll go through the motions, but it's having the opposite effect. Instead of doing something to make me want to feel closer to Hashem, I am doing an act which technically is supposed to make me feel closer to Hashem, but indeed what's happening is emotionally pushing me away from Hashem. And that's not a real, that's a trait for chumrah, not a kosher chumrah. It's a chumrah that's maybe the day cooler. It's a chumrah that has the opposite effect. It's counterproductive. Now, the realm of this mitzvah, kedoshim tiyu, is that which is heter, which is mutter, right, I should want on my own, not just because of public pressure or because of peer pressure, whatever else I'm doing, but I should want that it should be an expression of my emotional desire to come closer to Hashem. So therefore, that which I would want, that which is mutter for me to do, right, I am restraining and refraining from doing this because of Kedusha. An example which I think would be a much more practical thing to do, which I should practice, but I think here, okay, for someone in our society, I'm going to get a lot of flack on this one, all right? In our society, it's everybody eats in public, right? I don't mean at a banquet, at a dinner. I'm talking about in the street, right? People are chomping at food in the street all the time. Well, Chazal tell us, and people who are couth, right, realize that that's not, human beings should eat sitting down like a mensch, not running, not chomping, but we all do it, okay? If I would want to be more of a mensch, I want to be more of a human being, a dignified human being, and say, I am not going to eat in, on the street like that. I'm going to sit down and eat. I'm going to sit in private. It's not going to be out in the open where other people are just walking back. So that would be an element of Kedusha. I want to dignify myself. I want to make myself into a more sophisticated, more refined human being, okay? So is it us in the street? No, it's not us in the street. We all do it. Even Gedolei Yisrael do it. Is there a lack of dignity of a human being? Yes, there is. Does that possible human being? No, it doesn't. All right. So that's the concept of Kedusha. So let's go look at this question again. Okay. All right. Is there still something commendable about refraining from self-stimulation? Where that question? Yes, there is. It is commendable. Yes, if I do it in order to become more kadosh, to become more dignified as a human being. Right. Yes. Is it a level I should be striving to? I can't say that. I don't know. Depends on the person, right? Will it be productive or will it be counterproductive? Will it be inspirational? Will it cause resentment? Is it a totally neutral thing? Ikar Adin, it's a neutral thing, right? Not better one than the other. In other words, halachically, it's neutral. Kedusha-wise, yes, there's something to say, all right? I am referring back to the question. Here I'm referring to the spiritual aspect, meaning as a Bas Yisrael, does it affect my level of Kedusha? I don't like the way that part of the question was phrased. Does it if you do not restrain yourself, you are at the level of Kedusha that you innately have and that you've regained for other things that you do. Okay? If you mean will you move higher in your level of Kedusha by refraining, yes. As long as it doesn't cause resentment, okay, that will undermine what you're trying to do. So this is a very sophisticated question with a sophisticated answer because now we're dealing with the full dynamic of what Avodas Hashem involves. Okay, but we have to always be honest and keep in mind that I can't do something that ostensibly I'm doing it in order to become holier, firmer, and really it has the opposite effect. Okay, next question that this young lady asked. Secondly, how do I know if I'm addicted to sex? All right? So, in parentheses, I am single, so the only form of sexual pleasure I can be addicted to right now is self-stimulation. Okay, so therein you have already told me that you're not, okay? Because if you were a sex addict, you wouldn't be holding by sexual pleasure only for yourself. God forbid if you were a sex addict, you'd be knowing about all other ways to satisfy yourself outside of self. All right? Now, if you have doubts as to whether or not you are addicted to what you are doing, okay, so then you could take the questionnaires, all right? Every 12-step program on its website has the questionnaire, which I think it was the 14 questions or so, okay, and they ask you, and it depends, are you dependent on it? In other words, the activity that's involved, whether it's the alcohol or it's the drugs or it's the sex or it's the gambling or it's the shopping, there is no Shoppers Anonymous yet, but there should be. There are, Readers Anonymous, Food Addicts Anonymous, all these, there's always, on their website, there are questionnaires, all right? And the questionnaire demonstrates by answering honestly whether or not I need this thing to function, all right? I cannot function without it, okay? You'll look at the questionnaire, and they tell you by the number of questions you answered, yes, or no to, they'll tell you whether there's a strong possibility whether or not you have an addiction or not. Now, let me just complete the question here and finish the answering here. All right. I have been watching porn for some time now to arouse myself after listening to my regular share. Stop porn. I'm very gratified that I've had some influence on you. Thank you very much. And try just physical stimulation. Okay. However, I am wondering if my need for this pleasure is bordering on unhealthy. So that's a possibility. Okay. Every human being has a need for sex. Does that mean that you have to have sex every day? No, it's not like food. Food you have to eat every day. Sex, you don't need sex every day unless there's something not correct health-wise or deprivation-wise or something like that, in which case then that's part of our conversation is, right? But to say that a need for this pleasure is unhealthy is not correct. That's normal, all right? And whether or not, he says, I'm not doing dangerous things or against the law or anything as extreme as what real sex addicts deal with. So I would recommend that that you find, well, you don't have to read the whole book, but there's the basic book on sexual addictions. It's written by Patrick Carnes. It's called Out of the Shadows. And in my book, I reproduce, beginning of the S addiction section, I reproduce a chart wherein he describes the levels of sexual addiction. And the first part, the first level, has nothing to do with illegal things or dangerous things against the law. It's things that are considered, you know, all right, people do that, okay? And it nevertheless, it's a sexual addiction anyway. Patrick Carnes, then, of course, his whole book is the primer. He's written many books. He's famous about. He's one of the trailblazers in the research and in the treatment of this, of the sex addiction. Let's continue with the question. However, I feel like something isn't healthy about my behavior. Well, maybe I've touched on it just now. You can look at the questionnaires. You can find out perhaps what the reason is that you are doing this with some therapy, etc. Okay, and that's the question. What is the line between the normal desire for pleasure and an unhealthy need? And that was the questionnaire. That'll be whether are you dependent upon it or not. All right, is there a compulsion? Is there a dependency? Okay, let's see the next question. Okay, this was a woman who's an addict herself, and because, is masturbation okay for me as an addict if I'm not fantasizing? Does it make a difference halachically? This is based on the fact that since last week I said that if you're not, that the fantasizing is prohibited, it's usur, but if you just masturbate on itself by yourself with no fantasizing, then halachically it's mutter. And as we discussed, of course, the kedusha is something to be considered. But does it halachically make a difference? Okay. Now the answer to that question, surprisingly, is that if you know you're an addict, yeah, halachically it makes a difference even if it's mutter. Okay. Because there's a mitzvah, right? A mitzvah and a lotzah say both, I have to take care of my health. And it's not like an optional type of thing to do, right? No, I will keep Shabbos and this and that and all the other mitzvahs, but take care of my health, you know, that's my business. I don't have to worry about what God has to say about that. No, that is incorrect. There's a mitzvah in the Torah, in the Shemarat and Oda Nafsha Seich, that you must take care of your health. Having an addiction, a compulsion, an obsession, those are unhealthy. They're not good for you emotionally, psychologically, and most likely physically as well. And therefore, there's a halachic obligation to deal with it. So whereas masturbation for someone who is not addicted would be a permissible activity, someone who is addicted to masturbation or sexually, and that masturbation then becomes forbidden because you have to go take care of your health. And this is, it would be food. It's something we all need. Overeating is unhealthy. To overeat, well, we just, you know, pluck at it. But overeating really is an avera. If I'm putting my life in jeopardy by overeating, I'm not allowed to do that. Halach is prohibited. Okay, that may sound very strong, and I apologize, but that's the fact. Because Hashem wants us, Hashem gave us a body. The body is supposed to be able to function healthfully, so that it should be able to perform what we need to do in this world. If I make myself sick, I'm not going to be able to do what I need to do, and therefore, I'm not doing what Hashem wants me to do with my body. Okay, Rachelin, those are the questions, those are the follow-up questions and the clarifications on the masturbation. Would you want to interrupt if there are further questions, or do you want me to go on to the questions that were submitted before?
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kiganoff. Let's see if we have any questions, and if not, we'll go on. Are there any questions? Okay, looks like not. I think we can move on then.
Okay, very well. Okay. Okay, there were here now about four or five other questions on basically two or three different topics. So I'm going to deal with one that appeared twice first, okay? If homosexuality, the question reads like this. If gay is such a bad thing, one of the worst to'evos of Hashem, why did Hashem create this? For example, Hashem removed the desire for idols because of the damage done. Shouldn't gay be removed too? Okay? Powerful question. Okay, the question, though, is based on a misunderstanding, which unfortunately too many of our society misunderstands this, okay, and therefore we have also to, okay. There's a difference, a very big difference, between the same-sex attraction, called SSA, and acting out upon it, okay? A person can be gay, they don't have to act upon it. They don't have to have sex. All right? I'll give you an example, and then I'll explain a little bit more in a minute. Okay? But the a man, right, may have a strong desire, right, to be with a woman who's married, someone else. And she may have a strong desire to be with him, but that doesn't mean they can act upon it. All right? He can have a strong desire to be with his wife when she's a needer. And she can have a strong desire to be with him when she's a needer, but they don't act upon it. So the desire is one thing, and the acting upon it is second. The to'eva that the Torah talks about, the to'eva is when homosexuals act upon it. That's a to'eva. Okay, but to have the same-sex attraction is not. Okay, where does the same-sex attraction come from? So that is a dispute, all right, amongst the expert. There are those who say, now, I'm telling you what the facts are. In the popular press today, some of what I'm going to say is you can't talk about it. You're not going to say it because the gay lobby, like the GLBT, gay, lesbian, bigender, and transgender lobby is so strong, so controlling of the minds of people, and they have such a strong lobby that if you say anything different than they want to hear, you get clobbered. Okay, the experts disagree as to where a same-sex attraction originates. Okay, some say it's nature, all right, which means that people are born that way. Okay, and some say it's nurture. Some say it's not because people are not born that way. It's because of events that have occurred early in their life, right, that have now caused them to have an attraction to the same sex. Now, obviously, if it is correct that it's something that's happened in their earlier life, so then the question of why God created is not a non-question. It's a non-question, right? Hashem didn't create it that way because of human beings doing things, right, to other human beings that have caused it. So this then would default back into the same question that if someone gets his legs chopped off by a Russia, right, why is that person lame for the rest of life? He did nothing. The other person was a Russian, chopped his legs off. Right, that's the question at hand. Always is about the hashgacha, what Hashem was doing, why, and that's a separate hashgachic question. Right, there are at least 13 factorial answers to that question. Why do bad things happen to good people? All right, and I'll give you my mekaymus on that at a different time. I can't remember the name of the. This in my mind, but one of the lecturers from Osamech in Yerushalayim, he wrote a book, can't remember the name anyway, but he discusses all the very why bad things happen to good people. So that's if SSA happens, says that attraction happens because of something that occurred early in childhood. The question only begins, though, if what happens if it's nature, if it is actually nature, all right, not nurture. That means that it happened, a person was born that way. Well, if a person is born that way, also, Hashem gives men, different people different nisyonos. That's a different journey they have to take in life. Now, if a person was born with the same-sex attraction, so the person has to, first of all, verify that indeed they have such a thing, and if they do, now, then have a consultation. What is their path in life? How do they go about this? Okay, now, why I said verify is because if someone with the same-sex attraction comes to me, and they do, they ask me, how should they deal? So the first thing is I suggest that we investigate psychologically whether or not indeed that is what they have, or is it something that occurred later in life and can it be corrected, or not corrected, can it be changed, because they want to be able to function in our society, in our community, with the regular role that they have. Namely, they've been given a body of a woman and they want to function as a woman, or they have been given the body of a man and they function as a man and they don't want to be attracted to the other sex, or the same sex, I should say. So if that can be changed so that they want, because they want to fit in with everybody else and not be felt like excluded, then that would be an approach. Now, if not, all right, if that wouldn't happen, right, so now what shall be done? Okay, so now I want to share with you two stories, two very famous cases. One, the person involved is not well known, Baruch Hashem, because he wouldn't want to be known, okay? And the other one, the person actually wrote about himself. Okay, I'm talking about men, all right? Now, where the men is a much more, I should say, the man has a mitzvah of having children. When he has a same-sex attraction, it becomes, besides the annoyance, right, and the possibility, right, but he also, how does he get children if he's not attracted to his wife? Right? This becomes problematic. Right, so now there are two stories. One, there is a big Talmud Chacham who has written Svarim, extensive Svarim, very, very profound Svarim on Tanakh. Okay, and he, right, has SSA, right, and when he consulted with his Rosh Yeshiva, the solution that came up was that he should become a mashulach for yeshiva. A mashulach in those days, right, would go far off places to collect money for the yeshiva, and would not necessarily have support services there for there's no family, there's no one there, right? But because, and he would have to be a long time away from home. Well, for a married man to be a long time away from home was not realistic. But if a man is not married, okay, it gave him opportunities to be able to do things at distances for the yeshiva, which married men could, men who had wives and responsibilities to a married wife, marriage, would not be able to do. So he ended up traveling for the yeshiva, collecting money, and he ended up writing profound svarim, and he remained celibate. He just did not act upon his same-sex attraction, right? And instead became a very powerful fundraiser for the yeshiva and also Talmud Chacham. And this is how he dealt with his same-sex attraction. Now, I can make available to Rachelea, and there was an article published, this must be about, I can tell you when it was published, I have it in front of me, in 5 years ago, right? So long ago, where a fellow named David Benkoff, all right, it is about children. All right, now he describes his journey, right, from being not from to becoming absolutely from and religious. And the title of his article is Orthodox, Celibate, Gay, and That's Okay. And he describes very much in detail all the various, besides telling his own personal story, he also describes all the other approaches that are brought to bear concerning same-sex attraction and homosexuality and all those other things. And he says, he debunks it. He says, listen, the Torah tells us what the Torah says it wants us to know, and that someone has a nisayon, that is a nisayon, and that's the person's journey through life, and a person can live with it and be very happy and okay with it. And that is what he has done for himself. Now, I have shown this article to some lesbians I have conversations with, and they have said that they find that what he has said they're not satisfying to them. Okay, so there is still more research and work to do to help psychologically and theologically to be able to understand the phenomenon. But gay is such as a bad, let me go back to the question, is gay such a bad thing? The acting out upon it is the bad thing. That's where it's a toave. Okay, that a person could have a same-sex attraction, that's not what Hashem makes a toave. Hashem says that I may give someone perhaps a same-sex attraction, which some experts think is nature. I personally do not believe it's nature. I believe it's nurture. The bad events that have occurred as a result of what other human beings have done to this person, right? And now is not the time to go into more detail about that. But so I believe that it's nurture. It's because of events that other humans have perpetrated, and therefore Hashem didn't create any of it. It's all because of human misfunction, dysfunction, evil, however you want to put it. Okay. Let's see, we have some few more. The other question is, what do we have, 3 minutes, 4 minutes left? What do we have here? Oh, no, we have more time. We have about, okay, so let me try another one here. Okay. They're all difficult questions, not difficult. Let me try this one here. Okay? So the other ones are more lengthy. I'm really at a loss what to do here. Okay. Okay. Why are the topics of sex, gay, masturbation, and porn all taboo? By knowing this, it saves people from so many things. All these things happen because we don't know about it. Shouldn't there be education about this? Okay. So the answer to that question is like this. Once upon a time, all this education, all this discussion wasn't necessary because everyone grew up in similar upbringing. You grew up in a shtetl, right? There wasn't that much exposure to the outside world. The mores and the values of the community and the families were one and the same. And therefore, everybody knew, just like everybody knew, shikur is a guy that who gets drunk, the guy, no, you don't get drunk, which may or may not have been true, but everybody had that attitude and opinion, right? So here also, this type of material was not necessary to be discussed at all about this. It was all self-understood. About 30 years ago, when Mayor Ed Koch was mayor of New York, so he passed legislation about the gay rights. So I remember I was in the Beit Medrash, I was in the Kollel at the time, and the Novominsky Rebbe was the Rosh Hashiva, and he got up and by the Aron Kodesh there, and by the Bima, by the Aron Kodesh there, and he said, I have to speak this afternoon about something that should not be spoken about in the Makom Kodesh. Shouldn't speak about it here. However, he said, because today in day and age, everything is all confused, all mixed up and confused. If you don't clearly state Das Torah, and it has to be spoken here from the Makom HaTorah, from the Aron Kodesh, right, people won't know. So I have to talk about it. But I must tell you that this is a aberration of our society that such things have to be discussed. Okay, and that's what it is today, too. We have to talk about it, okay, because you're right. Today we have to talk about it because otherwise people don't know and they get lost and they get to do all sorts of things. Now, here we run into another problem. Because we have no chinuch on how to mechanech on these topics, people are afraid. Right? That's why no one wants to talk about it. So besides the fact that once upon a time we never had to talk about it, right? People don't know how to talk about it and we're afraid to talk about it. And I'm sure that there'll be many who are very critical about my being so open and talking like about it, but I feel it need be have as the question is that we should talk about it. People know. And then there's the third answer why we don't talk about it, and that is because if we talk about, let's say in a class, in high school, senior class, talk about these things, right? So then we're afraid because, yeah, there may be 4, 5, 10 girls in the class, right, who need this education. But since there are 15 or 20 others sitting there who are quote-unquote innocent, so now that I bring the topic on the table and discuss it, they get ideas. So why should I give them ideas, right, when the other girls need that, but they don't? Then all I'm doing is making it worse for them by giving ideas which they wouldn't have thought about anyway. Okay, that thing is also flawed because if I don't teach, they'll find out about it in the street. Okay, rare is the person who today in today's age can actually protect themselves from not being influenced by our technology, by exposure in the street, in the subway. So some of our communities try very hard to be insular. We have our own transportation in our own cities, in our own towns, in our own shtetla. After all is said and done, the technology will seep in under the door. All right? And that's why it's my belief that education is very important on all of these things. But your question was, why were these things not discussed? So there you have the three answers. Either we're afraid to discuss it because we don't know how to, because once upon a time, it was never necessary, so we have no chinuch on how to mechanech, or we're afraid that the innocent may get ideas, and therefore we don't want to mechanech, which again, also, I believe to be a flawed approach. All right, so there are two questions here that did not get answered yet, so Rachelet, I leave it to your discretion what we should do about it, but right now it's only 2 minutes left of the time period, so there is definitely not enough time for me to discuss these two questions.